First, though, tea at three, and our guest today is the singer and songwriter Ralph McTell. Best known, I guess, for his haunting hit The Streets of London, Ralph has been at the very top of the acoustic scene for decades. He's often on tour, and indeed his latest one brings him to Martlet's Hall in Burgess Hill tomorrow night. So we're thrilled that we can have him for tea at three today. Hello, Ralph.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Bill.
Yeah, is it a venue that you've played many times before, the Martlets?
No, I'll tell you, I know Burgess Hill because when I was very much younger, I used to hitchhike down to Brighton a lot, and I used to see that sign to Burgess Hill. I've never been there, actually, so just when you think you've been everywhere, there's Burgess Hill.
Well, will you get there in time to have a bit of a snoop around, then,
Well, I think probably we normally get into the theatres about between 3 and 4 to set up and everything, so maybe I'll have a little stroll around and have a little look at the place.
Very nice. And what will the set comprise of?
Well, it's difficult these days. There's just so many songs to choose from, but inevitably I will play my hit, but I will be looking backwards and forwards. I think that's... I try to sort of pull songs from the very dim, distant past, you know, from my first album came out in 1967, 68.
Wow.
So there's an awful lot of material out there. So I'd be diving right back and coming right forward. I've actually got couple of new things to play as well, so how are we going to squeeze everything in? I don't know, but have fun trying anyway.
You call it the hit, and of course everybody knows exactly what you mean, and I couldn't resist referring to it in my introduction even.
No, that's okay.
Is it okay? I mean, is it a little bit of a millstone? Do you wish people would talk more about other things that you've done, other songs that you've written?
Well, of course, but you can't have a little millstone, can you? There's always a great big thing like hanging around your neck. And
is it a great big millstone?
Well, it is, but it's not an unpleasant one. I mean, the thing is, the song has substance, and it has come to mean so much, not just to the general public. And I'm not being, I don't want to be falsely modest. I mean, I'm always amazed that I had any success at all, because with anything in terms of songwriting, it's something I was never striving to make hits. I was only striving to express my feelings, and I just had this bit of luck, as you might say, because it's earned me some money, but it's also prevented a lot of other stuff coming through, because if you've only ever had one, and it's kind of got this sort of, I don't know, social, religioso, I don't know, it gets used in schools, in churches, and all sorts of places, and it's used as a guitar tutorial and everything, so it's got lots of little things going for it, and you know, you can't help sometimes thinking, oh, I wish I could get away from it. But as soon as I start to sing it, I get into it again. And I it's not like... I always tell people, you know, the number one slot that year was held by Mudd with a song called Are You Lonesome This Christmas. Now, if I'd had to sing that every night since 1974,
yes,
I might feel differently about it. But I certainly don't about Streets. No, I don't feel bad about it at all.
When you were writing it, presumably it just felt like writing one of the many songs that you were writing at the time, didn't
Absolutely.
It?
It was just, this is a good topic to have a go at. Let's see where this goes. And exactly. And then for years it was three verses. It finished with the old man in the all-night cafe. And then I thought, it's sort of left hanging there. So the next verse got written, I mean, probably a year later. And that's how most people know the song, with four verses and four choruses, yeah.
And do we have any idea how many covers there have been of it?
Well, the documented covers, those are from people that have been polite enough to write to the publishers and say, is it all right if we record this? There are about 212 or 13 acknowledged covers, but of course there's a lot more than that.
Any you particularly like, or any that you cannot bear?
There's quite a few. I'm not going to name anyone. But there's some very fine ones. Glen Campbell did a particularly fine one. Harry Belafonte did a beautiful version. Cleo Lane. Charles. There's a lot of really, really nice ones, you know.
Hear people like that doing your songs, yeah. I was reading through the biog, and the name of another fine composer of a rather different style leapt out at me, Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Yes.
What was the connection there?
Well, my dad was... he's a bit of a shadowy figure, my dad. I didn't know him at all. He left our family home quite early and moved down to a place near Lawton in Sussex, near Brighton somewhere, where he unfortunately was killed in an accident. That's how we got to hear where he was.
Gosh.
But apparently, he was born in a place called Addington in Surrey, and his father worked for, I think, the Archbishop of Canterbury's estates there, and also worked as a gardener for Ray Vaughan Williams. And my father apparently told my mother that he liked that music, and and they thought Rafe was rather a good name, a bit posh for us working class people, but so he changed it to Ralph, and I've always been called Ralph, and apparently that is my connection with Rafe.
So you are named after Mr. Vaughan Williams. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
You've been quoted in the past as saying that your father's desertion shaped you totally. Do you still stand by that, and what exactly do you mean by it?
Well, absolutely. I think I was probably a sensitive little boy anyway, and I was very well aware of the impact that it had on our family from the moment he went and the door slammed. And, you know, that colours the way you view what your mum does. And, you know, in those days there wasn't the kind of help available to people, and mum went out and worked, scrubbed doorsteps even. She did everything to keep this, our little family together.
Which was you and your brother.
My brother and myself, yeah. And her, yeah. And, of course, we went without, although we didn't feel that we went without, because we were together, and we roughed it together. And it was extremely tough. And when people say it was tough for everybody, it might well have been after the war, but it was tougher for us because there was no money, and mum kind of kept everything together. So that sensitivity to that situation, music and words and poems and stories were incredibly important to me. They gave me a great deal of comfort, and eventually led me into music, which has been my life. So I have to say that it shaped me totally.
Now, again, reading in the notes, I was interested to see a section on your discovering of black music, because if there's one kind of music that one perhaps doesn't think of in connection with you, it would probably be that, wouldn't it?
Well, it's absolutely. I mean, it's a strange phenomenon that English working class lads took American black music back to America and made it popular, and lots of them, like B.B. King was on TV recently, the great blues guitar player, and saying thank you very much for doing that, because it raised the profile of black music, especially blues, and for me especially the guitar, because these men often, you know, surmounted dreadful disabilities and blindness and all sorts of ailments and, you know, disablements to produce the most incredible, beautiful, original American art form, which is blues and jazz. And we picked up on the message. Post-war kids seem to pick up on the message of the songs, and of course I wanted to play guitar like that, and I have my collection comprises a huge amount of black acoustic blues music, and I still listen and am amazed and full of wonder at what they managed to achieve, and I'm still learning from them, I'm still trying to play like them, and of course I don't play blues exactly, but the techniques that I have, well, I do play blues actually, but the techniques I have learned from fingerstyle playing have guided my accompaniments and compositions to my own songs.
The other thing that surprised me, because you don't associate it with a tortured artistic guitar balladeer, was army life, but you even tried that out for a short while.
Well, that's the typical refuge for the wayward boy, isn't it? I mean, as an amateur kind of sociologist, if you like, at 15 when I joined up, because you could, and I think you still can, join up at 15, I discovered to my utter amazement that there was only one boy in our recruit intake that had both parents at home.
Mm.
We were all from broken homes, every man jack of us, and the army's always known that. It used to recruit out of orphanages and Barnardos and so on, and boys from broken homes or single-parent families are somehow drawn to the kind of family that the army suggests it might be. So you have the security of belonging to something, and yet you have the adventure and the channel for your bravado and so on, you find out immediately on arrival it's not all skiing and, you know...
And one big loving-kind family necessarily,
exactly,
either.
Exactly, Mundo. Yeah. But at the time it seemed a way of getting out from under and exploring something different and having a little dignity and possibly, although I wouldn't be aware of that word, but getting out of the responsibility of coming up to the standard that my dear old mum's sacrifices deserved, you know.
How did your dear old mum felt, having sacrificed, when you then became a busker?